Welcome to the Friday Night Clive podcast with me, Clive Payne. In this podcast, we look back at the amazing charities, organisations and people we have chatted to over the past few months, all of whom have interesting and important stories to tell. Now, sight loss can hit any of us at any stage in our lives for a variety of reasons. Whether one is partially sighted or totally sight impaired, one has to completely adjust one's lifestyle to compensate for this. But how should one go about this and what options are available? I'm joined by Ranjit and Kim and Mina from the Beacon Centre for the Blind, and they're with me here in the studio. Hello, everybody.
Hello.
Hi, Clive.
Thank you very much for joining me. Cam, first of all, tell me about the Beacon Centre for the Blind and how it was formed.
Yeah, sure. So we've been going for around 140 years, since 1875. And obviously, we started off small as a charity that supports people with sight loss and visual impairments. So that can range from people being fully blind to mild visual impairments as well. And that's obviously a massive broad range. Over time, obviously, the charity has changed, but the core values haven't changed, supporting people to become more independent and live fuller lives. And that can vary in many different ways. So from learning how to cook your own meals, to learning how to use tech in everyday living. And it can be even more sociable things like helping you with employment skills and sports as well. So what we do is vast and varied, but the main core element is to help people with visual impairments live more independent lives.
So how has it progressed to the present day then in all that time?
Yeah, I think one of the things is we know that sight loss is becoming a bigger and bigger issue. First of all, obviously, as we all get older, we're all going to, unfortunately, more of us are going to develop sight loss issues as well. And that means more of us need support. The other aspect is the way people lived over 100 years ago is very different to now. Obviously, there was limited options for the disability community 100 years ago. Today is very different. You know, getting a job shouldn't be that difficult. Integrating into society, doing everyday things like taking the bus, going to play your favourite sport, etc. That should all, in reality, be, you know, part of your normal day life. And we're here to support people to fulfil their ambitions, dreams, whatever you want to call it. But that needs us to sort of talk to the individual. There's not a one-size-fits-all approach with us.
No, I bet there isn't.
Absolutely. You have to come to us, tell us what your needs and aspirations are, and we'll start talking to you and thinking, right, this is how we approach. I mean, We are expanding, and we're proud to say that we're working more and more in Staffordshire now, which is a big deal for us. And obviously, we want to mirror the success we've had in the Black Country and start doing that in Staffordshire more and more.
Mina, I'm going to come to you. How has the Beacon Centre helped you?
Yes, the Beacon Centre has helped me in many ways. Currently, I'm doing a BBO training course.
Oh, that's interesting. What's that?
So that's building bridges, giving opportunities for people to get into a job. Also taking various training. So for myself, I've done a confidence and assertiveness course, and anger management, which again, emotionally, has kind of helped me and boosted my confidence.
What sort of challenges have you faced with sight impairment?
Okay, so my sight impairment is from birth. I've got glaucoma. So I have no sight in my left eye and very limited in my right eye. I'm also deaf in my left ear. So having those disabilities has a huge impact on my day-to-day life. So just tackling normal things can kind of be a real struggle. But Beacon kind of shows you a path on how to deal with these issues by socialising with other people who have got similar visual impairments as yourself.
Ranjit, what about you? How long have you been involved and used the services of the Beacon Centre?
I've been involved now nearly over 10 years with the Beacon Centre, when gradually I lost my sight. I've got a condition called retinitis pigmentosa, which was diagnosed in 1997. And just to be told, when I was fully sighted, well, I used to wear glasses, but more or less I was your everyday outgoing person, family man, married, got my own house. Even when I was diagnosed and they said, you know, you've got retinitis pigmentosa, but this long-term thing in approximately about 10 years is going to send you blind, was a pretty hard pill to swallow. But I got on with life. You know, I was outgoing. I used to play a lot of sports. Football was I was very keen on. I was working. I worked for an engineering company in Wensfield, and got on with life until the day came, so he got the better of me, and basically I had to give my job up, and I was resigned to just sitting around at home.
That must have been an awful blow.
It was.
Well, that's putting it mildly, I think.
But. Yes. People, it's easy to say to somebody, you know, if you can't do your job now, you know, you've done your bit in society, you know, you paid your taxes. It was basically, I was resigned to sitting at home. Summers wasn't too bad. I could get out the front, you know, just at the front door or in the garden. But when winter came, that was even harder because I couldn't even get out into the garden.
No, that's right. So did you approach the Beacon Centre, you and Mina, obviously independently, or how did you actually get that first involvement?
Well, for me, it was actually through Ranjit Bothroy. Ranjit went to a local temple to do a speech about the Beacon Centre, mm-hmm. and let the community be aware of what's available. And at the time, my mum was in the temple, so she came back home and informed me. And that inspired me to kind of take that lead as well, knowing that there is support out there, and that people who are visually impaired, be surrounded by them to kind of get that connection and move forward.
What about you, Ranjit? How were you first involved?
I think it was something, I don't know where it came from. It was an inner voice. I was more or less was just sitting around at home. And the actual point where, again, how it came about, I don't know, because I was just sort of, I used to sit around in the house waiting for the wife to turn up from work. 2:30 was the sort of time, you know, and I used to know my wife's going to be here any minute now. So it was just that waiting and waiting. And the one day I was sort of sitting in the bay window, just sort of waiting for the hit, because I live in a cul-de-sac, it's really quiet. Mm-hmm. I could hear the car sort of pull up on the drive, but just sitting in the window, but not realising my wife had gone shopping. And I was sitting in that window for over an hour, more or less, I had to sort of tell myself, this is not right. Mm-hmm. And that's when I got in touch with Wolverhampton Council to tell them that, look, I need some sort of support, some sort mm-hmm. of help. Mm-hmm. Very fortunate, the centre was more or less across the road from where I live, and it's probably the best thing I ever done.
Tell me about the challenges that people from the BAME community face where sight loss is concerned.
That's my role now at the Beacon Centre. I'm the BAME officer. Like Mina says, I do go out into the community with camera support. We work with social media, be it online, radio, TV, and we promote across the board talking about living with sight loss and tackling stigmas that are also attached to the BAME community, especially even in the Asian community. Mm-hmm. And overcoming those barriers, and we can sort of promote that and make people understand, like we said, we don't bash people over the head saying, you're doing wrong. This is passed down from generations and generations, mm-hmm. Some people's beliefs. So we want to change people's mentality towards people with disabilities, living with a sight condition, that, you know, it's not end of, that you are resigned to sitting at home. There is life with living with sight loss, and we are now actually proving it. And Mina is a perfect case study for us, that she's come on leaps and bounds from what she was resigned to and what she's doing now. You know, she does talk, she's in blind sports. And I've seen a change within 12 months of, she calls herself a broken doll, but, you know, she's actually inspires other people now. Especially from the women perspective as well, sure. That you know, that I think it's even twice as hard for a woman from to live with sight loss.
It's very important, because we have, obviously from a BAME perspective, at Beacon we have a lot of people coming through the door living with sight loss, but obviously living in the West Midlands full stop, you have a huge sort of cultural mixing pot, and obviously we hope that that should reflect at the Beacon Centre. And we do have people from lots of different backgrounds, but the reality is, as a proportion of the population, a lot of people from ethnic backgrounds are still not coming through the door. Mm. So we have to ask ourselves that question.
Why?
You know, what is holding people back?
What have you found
exactly.
that is holding people
yeah,
back?
Yeah, and I suppose what Brandy's touched on, there is unfortunately a stigma, and the reality is there's actually a double stigma, if you want to call it that. Not only are you living with a disability, but you're from an ethnic background as well. And I suppose, culturally speaking, from many different backgrounds, people still have a perception that a disability is unfortunately a weakness within their family's eyes. So we need to hide that. I mean, like Francis said, there's pressure in the Asian community to get children married, you know, to make sure that they step up to life and do the things that everyone else does. But that comes down to people thinking, well, oh God, you know, my child's got a disability. How are they going to get married? How are they going to push forward in life? Are they going to be a burden on me? What do I do going forward? And that's an unfortunate reality. But as Ranjit said, we're not here to bash people over the head and say this is wrong.
No.
What we're saying is times have changed massively. There are options out there. If your son or daughter or you yourself want to be working in IT, for argument's sake, talk to us. We can help support you. We can teach you those skills. And we have lots to offer. So the message is, don't live in the darkness. Come talk to us. You know, website www.beaconvision.org. Have a look at what we do. Come down to the centre if you want to. Just have a quick look around. You know, there's no pressure, of course. And if you're not within the vicinity of Beacon, there's lots of other charities you can step into as well.
What research are you continuing to do to encourage people to come forward?
Yeah, absolutely. I think one of the main things is, obviously it was a small charity. We don't have the funds, the resources to go around doing massive pieces of research, to be honest. But what we do have is we do have a good finger on the pulse of society at the moment. Me and Ranjit go around doing a lot of talks, as well as Mina, at places of worship, be it a mosque, be it a temple, etc. And we find out that people still don't know that there are options out there. You know, the reality is people are still shocked that, for example, Ranjit can use his own iPhone with his talking technology app, which allows him to do things independently. People are still shocked that Ranjit can make his own cup of tea at home, thanks to a small device which beeps when the glass is full. All of these things people are still very shocked at, and therefore we know in reality there's still a huge gap. And we only have to look at the people stepping through the doors of the centre and what the demographic looks like. So the research suggests that there's still a lot of work to do, but that's going to take many, many years. We're not suggesting that, you know, thanks to anything we do, tomorrow will be very different. It will take time.
What is the age demographic that does come through the door?
Yeah, sure. It's absolutely massively different, to be honest with you. We have 18-pluses coming through, but then we have seniors coming through who obviously in reality are living with sight loss because, you know, of age and natural degeneration of your eyes. But then we also have middle-age groups coming in. We have people looking for employment support as well. So the age group is huge.
I had a listener question from Sue Edwards, who posted a question on Facebook. Sue, thank you very much for your question. Sue's question is, where does all the money go that you receive in donations?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a really good question, Sue. Well, first of all, obviously, as a huge centre, we operate, first of all, obviously, across the Black Country and across Staffordshire. There's many different initiatives. So if I just try to give you a quick rundown, it might help. So, first of all, we have low vision support, which is, say, for argument's sake, Sue, tomorrow you find out that you've just developed this sight condition and it's going to degenerate over time. You're going to come in, talk to us and say, look, I still want to do X, Y and Z. I still want to live my life, still want to play football, still want to do this. How can you help me? Well, we'll sit there giving you advice. But obviously that costs time and money for us as well. We have equipment which we can demonstrate to you and support you with. We also have trained staff as well that can help you there. We also have other initiatives as well, as I said, employment support team. We have a day centre which you can then sit there, learn new skills such as art, pottery, crafts. As I said, again, IT lessons. And we also do lots of work in the community in the sense of raising awareness, like projects like this. And in general, we also, most recently, actually, one of the most fascinating projects we do is the Fab Lab, which is a supportive technology unit. Mm-hmm. And essentially, that helps people with certain disabilities learn how to use modern tech. Now, for that argument, say you might want to make your own personalised T-shirt or personalised mug. We can help you with that. And it's all designed around the person's individual disability. Obviously, all of these services cost money. The reality is, like most charities, we are facing tough times. But tough times also mean that we are also supported by really, really generous community as well. People really do dip in for us. But I can only say we always need more. That is a harsh reality. So if any time Sue is, or anybody else that's listening is thinking, you know what, I could really do with, you know, I want to support a local charity. And the difference, the keyword there is local. You know,
yeah.
The money you're giving us is making an impact and you will see that locally.
Now, you talk about, you know, appliances, for example, Ranjit's device that tells him when the glass is full. Do people have to fund that themselves or is that equipment provided by the centre once you've actually given somebody advice?
So a couple of things here. First of all, it all depends on, this might sound generic, but it all depends on your circumstances, obviously. Mm. We all have different financial circumstances, which obviously we won't get into. However, majority of the time, most of the services you will have to fund for yourself. Now, That doesn't mean that's going to cost you an arm and a leg, mm-hmm. but small things like a cup measurer, which essentially you put it in within the cup and it beeps at you when the level is full.
I think that's really clever.
Exactly. And that allows something so simple as making a cup of tea a reality.
Well, we take it for granted,
absolutely,
don't we?
Absolutely. And funding-wise, it is all dependent. There is massive range. Ranjit, I know, has at home a talking computer. That's more on the extreme end. That is going to be quite pricey. However, there are some free things you can do. By simply downloading a free app on your phone, your phone becomes a talking computer in its own right. So if Ranjit's going down the supermarket and he wants to know what's the difference between a tin of peaches and a tin of beans, gets his phone out, it scans, it says this is a tin of beans. You know, and that is a massive difference.
Very clever.
And that's just your simple iPhone 7, iPhone 6, mm-hmm. Which is, you know, like the app is actually called Seeing AI. Mm-hmm. I can establish colour clothing. If I'm going to check what I'm wearing, it will say, oh, this is green or this is yellow.
Oh, I think that's fantastic.
It'll tell you your currency as well, that you've got a £10, you've got a £20. So it's all built into the phone. I can do my emails, I can read my text messages. Mm-hmm. And again, like Cam said, my computer at the moment is, you know, a valuable tool for my work, what I do. Mm-hmm. And that reads out my emails. I can read out my own letters. It's a massive tool that actually changes my life.
But I think it's also important to say, equipment is great, but there's also coping strategies as well. I think Mina touched on it previously. It's not always about the tech side of things. We have to also get trained staff to help you cope with life in general. You know, it can be a massive shock. And especially if you were sighted before and then the transitional period, that's very, very difficult. We have trained staff who can help speak to you and make you understand what life is going to be like and how you can adapt your life. That can be little things like moving furniture around or having things like, which barely cost a few quid, if anything, bump-ons. These are tiny little dots which go on key areas around your house. And that might be the 200-degree mark on your oven. It might be key numbers on your phone that you need. Or the correct setting on your washing machine. All of these little things don't cost much, and there's free techniques and then there's cheaper techniques. The reality is living within what your situation is and making sure we can adapt around you.
Mina, we've heard how Ranjit lives his life with the tech and various other things. How do you go along in the normal day-to-day of things? Have you got lots of tech to help you?
Yes. So when I joined Beacon, I wasn't able to use a laptop at all. Mm-hmm. But since I joined Beacon, there's various softwares that they use, like Supernova. So Supernova is a software which it's kind of voiceover. It talks back to you on every detail that is on the screen. So I'm not able to see most detailed things on the screen, but mm-hmm. this then would read everything back to me. So now I can actually use Word confidently and create a PowerPoint presentation.
Well, that's more than I can do because I'm rubbish with PowerPoint. It never works how I want it to do, that's for sure. Cam, what does the future look like for the Beacon Centre?
Yeah, well, if I can speak about this year is a huge year for us. It's 2020 and it's 10 years since we opened our building on Wolverhampton Road East, which is obviously a huge landmark for us. We've been around in our current location for the last decade. And 2020 is all about what we want to call is loving your local charity. We want people to actually show us some love within their local charity. We all love giving, and we all love giving to local good causes or good causes abroad, etc. But we want people to show us a bit of love this year and help us reach our target. It costs Beacon £1.2 million a year to sustain our centre. That's a lot of money, you know, and we have many different branches of obviously getting money, but the majority of the that we rely on is on the public. Excuse me. And what we want to do is encourage people this year to help us. Now, one of the things we have got going on is our 10,000 mile challenge. And that
Ooh,
is,
what's that?
So we're asking everybody in the community or across the country, full stop actually, to help us reach 10,000 miles. Now, don't worry, that's not an individual doing 10,000. What we are asking is...
You know, I'm so glad to hear that.
Absolutely. Everybody chipping in towards 10,000 miles. Now, obviously, all the details on our website, which I'll repeat again at the end. And that's all about signing up, donating £10 towards that. And that's only £10, and then you will be logging in your miles whenever you're doing them. Now, obviously, you could be a keen runner, you could be a keen jogger, you could be a keen swimmer or a cyclist, any form of exercise where you clock up the miles. Now, If you're worried, don't worry, you can even do walking the dog or walking to work, whatever form of mileage you can clock up. There's no individual target, but we want you to have a bit of fun and raise some money for Beacon. That's one. That's obviously 10,000 miles to mark out 10 years, of course. Mm-hmm. But there's also other little things as well. You can order a special donation box, which we're asking people to put 10p aside every day. And that's £36.60 throughout the whole year, which isn't a massive amount. But if you think about
it, everybody does that.
If everybody does it, we'd be well over our target, and that's what we want. We want people to show a bit of love and do very little things if they can. £10 isn't asking for a lot. That's, you know, that's two or three drinks on a night out. So we want people just to show us a bit of support. We are really, really reliant on everybody. And this year is our year to do that as well. But also, in essence, this is our year to expand as well. We're working more in Staffordshire, as I've said, and we're trying to get out more into the community to get people to come to us and say, look, I'm living with sight loss. I need a hand, you know. And we want to tell people to tell us what support are they looking for. Again, we're not one size fits all. We want you to talk to us.
Mina, in closing, what message would you put out to the BAME community who are experiencing sight loss, and how would you encourage them to come forward to approach Beacon for help?
Okay, as I'm from the Asian community, I would say that I do understand that there are cultural barriers and stigmas, but I can reassure you that Beacon can help. They do offer that emotional help and to help you move forward. I strongly advise. They don't do sympathy, but they do a lot of empathy.
Ranjit, what's your take on that?
Well, I just want to second that, what Mina has just first said, completely what she said. But I just want to touch on as well, having sight and then not having sight. I mean, I always promote, you know, at least once a year, you know, do get your eyes checked. Picking up any condition that, you know, might be there, finding it early, there's a chance that you can sort of maybe get it sorted. But once, you know, once a year, what's it going to cost? 20, 25 pounds?
It's not a lot. I mean, I have to have checks every year because some years ago they found a little mole on the back of my eyeball next to the optic nerve, and they keep checking it to make sure it isn't getting any bigger. It's about the size of a pinprick, but they now won't let me go without being checked every year. And for what it costs,
for what it costs, you know, to save your sight. I mean, we all like to wear nice clothes, look good, but all of that is, you know, what is all of that without sight?
Absolutely. So finally, how can people get in touch with you, Cam?
Yeah, many ways. Of course, there's a website, www.beaconvision.org. That's all one word, of course. Give us a call, 01902 880 111. Drop us an email on inquiry@beaconvision.org, or of course pop into the centre in person on Wolverhampton Road East, WV4 6AZ. It's about a 10-15 minute drive from here, from in Dudley. So really, we are situated in the Black Country, the heart of the Black Country, to be honest with you. We're on the borders of Wolverhampton and Dudley, so there's no excuses for people not to come see us. We've got a bus station right in front of us. If you're having problems, give us a call and we can work around you.
Lovely. I'll give those details out again a little bit later as well.
Thank you.
Thank you all very much indeed for coming and talking to Friday Night Clive.
Thank you for having us. It's all about you. It's all about you.
Black Country Radio. Beaconvision.org. That's their website address. Or ring them on 01902 880 111 01902 880 111. And if you fancy doing a bit of fundraising for them, then I'm sure they will be more than happy to have some help with that. You are listening to the Friday Night Clive podcast. If you like what you are hearing, don't forget to subscribe to get the latest instalment at blackcountryradio.co.uk/podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts from. Now, on with this week's episode. Now, autism is a lifelong developmental disability that affects how a person communicates with, relates to other people, and how they experience the world around them. An individual can sometimes present challenging behaviour, which is often misunderstood. Sylvia Stanway suffers from autism, as do her children, and joins me on the line to explain more. Hello, Sylvia.
Hello there.
Thanks very much for joining me. First of all, tell me what autism is and what causes it.
Well, you just read the definition. So, as you say, it's a lifelong developmental disability that affects how we see the world and interact with others. We don't say suffer, and we don't tend to say autism. We tend to say we are autistic. And being autistic means that we see, hear, feel, smell, process the world differently to the rest of you. What we suffer is the world. We don't suffer from autism.
So are there different types of autism then?
They used to think that, but with research, we tend to just say we're autistic. We don't tend to use terms anymore like Asperger's or atypical autism or high or low functioning. We, as I said, we say we're all autistic or autism spectrum condition. And the reason for that is people make assumptions. They may say that someone that's nonverbal is low functioning, but actually that person just could have an amazing brain but have a different way of communicating. If I'm working off a script at the moment, and I'm very comfortable because I'm talking about what I love to talk about, which is being autistic. But if I wasn't using my scripts, and if I wasn't in an environment that I'm comfortable, I may appear to be someone who is finding communication very difficult and challenging in behaviour. So we're only as good or as high functioning as our environment at any given time. I hope that's quite a good explanation.
It is. And I often hear people use a phrase very often as a throwaway comment, oh, we're all on the spectrum. Is it a reasonable argument to suggest that everybody is on the autism spectrum somewhere?
No, it's like saying we're all a bit pregnant because a pregnant woman feels sick in the morning, so does someone who's been out drinking beer the night before. You have the same symptoms, but for very different reasons. To meet the threshold for a diagnosis of autism spectrum condition, it's a very high threshold and a lot goes into that. So you may have, as I said, like morning sickness or sickness through drinking, you're both feeling pretty rotten and you can both empathise with each other's feeling, but you feel like that for very different reasons.
Tell me about your experiences of being autistic.
Okay, I wasn't actually diagnosed until I was a grown-up, and I spent many years struggling and being seen as quite either eccentric, difficult. I was in hospital for a while because I could no longer process the world. And for me, I'm at my best when I'm able to live on my own terms. So when I'm able to not have to try and be like the mainstream. So for me, I suffer lots of anxiety. And I have to make sure that I use my toolkit to get through. Was that the answer to the question?
It was.
Or did I digress a bit?
No, you did. That was perfect. And you were going on to say how it affects your day-to-day life.
Yes. Well, in my day-to-day life, I rely on functional people. So I love my husband dearly, but if he wasn't so functional, I don't think I'd be married to him. I'd love him, but I'd have to find someone to be functional for me. I know that sounds quite, I don't know how it sounds, it's honest.
Yes.
And I have people that are my friends, but they also drive for me. I have people that fill out forms for me. I have people that come to the hospital with me. I have a support worker when I need it. I have lots of people that fulfill certain functions so that I can focus on what I can do. Otherwise, it all becomes very overwhelming and I can't cope.
And you have people to support you in the way that you've just described. What coping mechanisms do you have on a personal basis that help you?
Anxiety medication helps me.
Yeah.
And if you think about it, I'm going to give an example of why anxiety medication helps me. If you have a 5-point scale, so put your fingers out, when most people wake up, people that don't suffer the kind of anxiety that autistic people suffer wake up on about level 1, which is equivalent to maybe smoking a funny cigarette or something. Mm-hmm. And then other people, when they get up, have a cup of tea, getting ready for work, they're on level two, so you're feeling a little bit anxious. Mm-hmm. But, you know, nothing too difficult. Level three is where there's a huge traffic jam and you're going to be late. Level four is where you get in and all the computers have crashed, so you're feeling really stressed. And level five is Hulk smash. So most of us autistic people wake up on about level three. Mm-hmm. So we start the day on a much higher anxiety level because we are a minority in a mainstream world. So we have so much more to process. And life is naturally a lot more demanding for us. Is that a good example?
It is. Where do you find help and support, though, other than within your immediate family and friends? So, you know, external sources or partnership agencies.
Sorry, I interrupted you.
No, not at all.
Autism West Midlands are amazing. They give a lot of support. Unfortunately, they've had their budgets cut to the bone. But I've had a lot of support from them. Other parents, I mean, central governments cut the funding so much that there's very little support out there for us now. We tend to almost have a barter of skills services. Like, I have quite a lot of knowledge, so I'll share my knowledge with someone and they'll drive me somewhere. We tend to end up as this exhausted army supporting each other. We need more support, but austerity has meant that there's a lot of isolated people out there that aren't getting anything. I'm very lucky. I have a good support network around me.
Now, you were diagnosed, as you said, when you were an adult. So how long have you experienced being autistic?
Since I was born.
Right.
Born autistic. I just didn't know it, so... for me, having a diagnosis makes perfect sense. It's made my life easier. I understand why I am the way I am. I'm much braver about saying, well, no, I'm not going to do that because that is bad for me. I don't try and fit in anymore. A lot of autistic people are encouraged to mask and to look neurotypical or normal. That nonsense word, normal, what's normal? But and it's actually very bad for us.
Yeah.
Us looking fine and looking normal means that we're not self-regulating and being ourselves. So the reason we flap our arms about, the reason we stim, the reason I dominate conversations, it's me self-regulating my anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, knowing that I am autistic actually stops me from shutting down and ending up in hospital because I simply can't cope anymore.
Now, I've made it no secret on this programme before that I have depression and anxiety, and I'm not medicating for it at the moment, but I work on the basis now that if something is right for me, and this is the point you've just made, if something is right for me, I will do it. If it's not right for me, I don't. But it's being strong enough to actually say, no, that's not right for me. I'm not going to do that.
Absolutely, and the validation of the diagnosis has helped me with that, and also fighting for my children. We have one rule in this house, and that is whatever's going on, we ask ourselves the question, are we safe?
Mm-hmm.
And if we're safe, we simply say nothing else matters, and whatever's going on, it doesn't matter. If we're not safe, then we make ourselves safe or make the children safe, and then nothing else matters. And leading a life where you're strongly resolved to only do what's safe for you and for your children, and do what's right for you, is actually the way that we're free enough to be ourselves and to lower our anxiety. So if you're suffering from anxiety and depression and making those decisions to only do what's right for you, that can only be beneficial.
Absolutely. And as you said, it's part of that coping mechanism which you referred to earlier on. Now, your children have experience being autistic. What's life like for them?
My son is verbal, very aggressive.
How old is he, if I may ask?
He's 13, actually. Goodness me, he's just 13.
Yeah.
He's in an LA maintained autism specific school, and he's doing really well. I mean, the hormones are kicking in, but he's hard work. He takes a lot of management. He doesn't sleep very much. He can be very aggressive. We have to use very low demand, low arousal strategies with him, and we have to not care about the rest of the world, just care about him. And actually, he's turning out really well, but he's really hard work. My daughter has a profile. There's a profile on the autism spectrum that is becoming more known. So she's got a pathological demand avoidance profile. So if you're autistic, you won't automatically have PDA, but you have to be autistic to be diagnosed with PDA. And what PDA means is that it's an anxiety-driven need to be in control. And she cannot cope with too many demands. So we just had her, she broke down in a mainstream school, and she was out of school for a year, pretty much in her room, because she couldn't cope with demands. So we've had to fight several tribunals, and she's now in a autism-specific independent school and doing very well. But environment was key. It needed to be a low arousal, low demand environment. And it illustrates the fact that we are a minority in a mainstream world, and what disables us is the mainstream world. If we're not allowed to be free and to be ourselves, it breaks us.
Now, is it possible to tell which side of the family being autistic comes from? Because is it genetic? Have you found this out in your experience and on your journey of learning?
I strongly believe it's genetic. If I look back in my family line, there's lots of wonderful characters. I mean, my dad's in his 70s, and he's coming to realise that he most likely is autistic. And the thing is, people say, oh, it didn't happen in my day. I mean, that drives me crackers. But if you think about it, life's very different now. Years ago, people had a lot less demands on them. So you had a job, and you had that job for your life. Communication, a lot of it was by letter. So you'd post a letter, someone would read it, you'd write a letter, post it back. So there was lots of processing time, lots of time to think. Life was less demanding, and there was a lot more routine and stability. It's much faster now. So those autistic people that would have always been seen as eccentric but got by really well, it was because the mainstream world was more hospitable.
Yes.
And actually, life is a lot more inhospitable for us now, and I think that's why people don't necessarily see the genetic links going back in the family, because the environment of the world has changed so much. But as I look back, I see in our family a lot of indicators that there is a long history of us being autistic.
It's interesting that you talk about your father, because I mean, my parents have long gone, unfortunately, but my dad, I found him very challenging when I was growing up, and there were some traits about him which, even as, you know, a little boy, 7, 8, 9 years of age, I couldn't understand. And I just thought, oh, crumbs, it's probably Dad just being Dad. And this continued really all his life. And there were certain situations and circumstances that he just could not cope with. And he would either go very quiet, or he would become particularly verbal, particularly vociferous about things. And, of course, when you're growing up, you don't understand, because you don't understand. But as an adult, I look back and I think, if my father was around now and he was, if we could stop his age and we could return him back to being 50s, 60s years of age now, he would be, I think, referred to or regarded to as being autistic, because all the things that I've learned about it over the years, I look back, and I was thinking about this today, actually, while I was reading through the interview brief, that he would be classed as being autistic today.
It's interesting, isn't it? With my father, I spent a lot of years batting heads with him, because we are very similar.
I did that too.
The more I've come to understand myself, the more I've come to understand my father, and he's come to understand me. And he is the person I can spend the most time with and actually enjoy time, because we either have very deep conversation or we don't talk, and I know his quirks, he knows my ways, and we just coexist. Other people say he's incredibly difficult to be around, whereas I find him the easiest person to be around. And it's amazing what understanding can bring, isn't it?
It is. But I found my dad particularly challenging. And we didn't have the best of relationships as I was going through adolescence and early adulthood. You just sit back and think, well, you know, it is what it is. I hate that phrase, but it's true. And you think, well, crumbs, there's nothing I can do about it.
Do you think it would be now if you could sit down with the knowledge you have now? How do you think it would be?
I still think it would be quite challenging, but I would probably ask more appropriate questions of him and get mm-hmm. him to, expose his thought processes and the things that he can't cope with more. But he would go from 0 to 60 with temper in 3 or 4 seconds about something that would be perhaps, that you and I would regard perhaps as quite trivial.
I do that.
Yeah.
I go from 0 to 60 for things that people find trivial.
But I think that's how his brain processes it, and you referred to that earlier on.
If you're anxious anyway, it doesn't take you much to get to that higher, to Hulk smash. If you're on 3 or 4, to get to Hulk smash doesn't take much. And for me, things that I have sequences that I work through, and if something's, I tend to deal with big issues more than small issues. So no milk in the fridge, I'll be having a complete apocalypse. Whereas if everything's going crazy, and my son's trying to throw me down the stairs, I can deal with that, whereas most people would be finding that really difficult. So is that the kind of example you're thinking
it
of?
It is.
That sort of?
Yeah. I mean, when you think about all the different coping mechanisms that you talked about earlier on, where do you find the best relief for it? Do you know what I mean? Do you have a safe space that you go to in your mind, or maybe in your house you listen to a certain type of music, you eat a certain type of food? What completely diffuses things for you?
For me, if I'm really anxious, I love my allotment. I only tend to grow slugs and weeds at the moment.
Well, you're growing something, Sylvia. That's a start.
Yeah, but being there and the space for me, and I find the seaside very cathartic. But talking, good conversation with someone with a good brain. I value people's brains more than I almost value people, if that makes sense. A good brain. For me, that helps. For my son, it's he needs cuddles and he needs to be told that we love him, and he needs to be on the go, and that's very stress busting for him. My daughter uses a lot of art and a lot of drama, and I think we all have our things that help us to calm down. Sometimes for me, it's wine, switching my brain off with wine. You know, it's not the best coping mechanism, but when my brain's so fast I can't slow it down, I'll have wine, obviously my husband looking after the children, and it just gives me a little break from my brain for a while.
Yes. Yeah. See, for me, it's animals, and I live in the countryside, so I can go to a nature reserve or the woods within just a walk of my house. But I find animals very therapeutic, much like you like the sea as well. I love looking at the sea and hearing it. And you can get CDs with sound effects onto that effect, and sometimes you can put that on. But for me, it's the countryside on a nice, windy, warm, sort of sunny day. And even if the weather isn't particularly good, just to get out and have a walk is fine. But a number of my friends have got pets, and I'm always happy to have the dogs, the cats, whatever, on my lap. And I mean, the Chris Packham from BBC Television made a remark in an interview in a magazine last year that he feels that he can relate better to animals than humans. And some people I think can, some people perhaps not, and as you say, we all have that different kind of sort of comfort space, that safe space where we take ourselves away, remove ourselves from the situation that's causing us the distress, and then we can, you know, go to that comfort space, and as you say, whether it's wine or whatever, or conversation, everybody's different, everybody deals with it in their own way. And it works.
One of the things I've always done, sorry to interrupt,
not at all.
gross people out a bit, though it's not completely inappropriate. I like watching videos of people squeezing spots. That helps me.
Right.
And lots of other things I quite like. I know a lot of people are going to find that strange, but I can do that for hours. And I can...
It's satisfying, though, isn't it?
It's totally satisfying and satisfying videos. And I like going into forums that are talking about autism or human rights and have a really good conversation, but it's so on my own terms and I haven't got to mix with anyone.
Sure.
Because I don't always like people.
No, I don't.
And I think that's what you have to be.
It's not good in this job.
Sorry?
I said, yeah, I don't always like people, but it's not good in this job.
No, I actually don't know how you can do what you can do. At the moment, I'm talking about what I want to talk about, so I can cope. But if I had to interview someone on a topic for the listeners that I wasn't interested in, I wouldn't be able to communicate. So I take my hat off to you, because I couldn't communicate like you communicate.
Sure. Oh, bless you. Sylvia, it's a fascinating subject, and I have learned a lot in the 20 minutes that we've been chatting. Thank you ever so much for your time this evening, for talking to me and sharing your experiences.
You're very welcome.
Have a super and peaceful night, and thank you for talking to Friday Night Clive.
You're very welcome. Thank you for listening. Bye-bye.
That's your lot for this episode. You can catch the show live every Friday night on Black Country Radio from 8 p.m. If you love our podcast, please subscribe by heading to blackcountryradio.co.uk/podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts from. See you very soon. This is a Black Country Radio podcast, presented by Clive Payne, production by Andy Caddick and Alex Griffiths.